Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast about agriculture and medicine with an emphasis on biotechnology and the good things we can do for people and the planet. I'm Kevin Folta. I'm your podcast host. And today we're going to talk about a couple different topics, but we're going to start out with the new Global Gene Editing Regulation Tracker. And we're speaking with John Entine and Kayleen Schreiber from the Genetic Literacy Project. The new resource is an online tool that allows you to understand the current status of gene editing as it's occurring. And I'd like to talk about the rationale behind it and how much it'll be updated and get more information about this really important tool. So welcome to the podcast, John and Kayleen.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here and talk about our project. Put a lot of work into it.
Glad to be here, Kevin.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, John. It's always good to talk to John. And so where did the idea to build this resource come from? I mean, it seems like an important thing, but no one else has done it. What was the rationale?
Kevin, I think that we at the GLP had come to a realization that there is a battleground in the area of biotechnology in general. Obviously, you focus more on the agricultural aspects of it, but also in the area of medical advances using gene editing, CRISPR, transgenics. And we felt that there's a lot of misinformation out there. And unfortunately, politicians, regulators who rely on the information cyberspace arena to find out about what's going on areas that they're developing policies for, go to resources that are just not accurate. And we felt that we wanted a clear, non-biased, transparent resource on what's being regulated in the gene editing sphere and in the medical area and agriculture involving gene drives, so that policy decisions can be separated from political and ideological debates.
That's really important. And maybe we should go backwards. Kathleen, what is gene editing and why is it so important for us to understand the regulations that go along with it?
Gene editing is a new technology that can be used for a broad spectrum of applications. And it basically is a way, a cheap and fairly simple way for scientists to be able to either delete or edit genomes of plants, animals, and even humans. And it's kind of a breakthrough technology because of the almost anyone with a scientific background, a molecular biology background can do it, and it doesn't take that much money. So it kind of has broken through, and people are just kind of figuring out all the different applications that it can be used for. So it's important. I think the technology, as always happens, has come before the regulatory landscape and it needs to catch up. And so understanding what the technology can really do and what it means and then how we should regulate it is really important.
So maybe, John, you could give me some hints about how it's currently regulated. I mean, where are we in the U.S. with respect to regulation in plants and animals?
Yeah, the structure that's existed for many years in the agricultural plant area has been pretty flexible relative to other countries. So we are product focused in our regulations, which is much more progressive, I think, than in other countries, which really have shut down the transgenic GMO revolution by focusing on process. Nonetheless, it's very laborious. It can take anywhere from 5 to some cases 10, 12, 15 years to get products that are transgenic approved. Gene editing changes the dynamic a little bit because we're not moving genes from one species to another, at least in the first step in the process in developing crops that are based on gene editing technologies. And that really removes a lot of the criticisms, I think, that are out there about GMOs and transgenics. So the regulatory system in this country treats agricultural products developed with gene editing almost as if they're conventional. I think a lot of companies that are developing these products still are submitting their information for evaluation just to protect themselves against attacks from hostile NGOs or even skeptical regulators. But in the agricultural area, I think gene editing has a looks fairly optimistic that we're going to be developing a lot of new products. The real problem comes in animal gene editing, which relies on regulations that literally date back to the 1930s on how the FDA regulates drugs. And so in some ways, we're a world leader, gene editing in crops. It appears to be we're developing that way in the U.S., but we're really a backwater when it comes to animal gene.
And what are some examples of animals or plants where gene-edited products have been approved?
Well, some of the things, again, are not necessarily, it's not necessary that they be approved. There's a gene-editing oil that has a higher nutritional value that has been developed and is already being sold. We have a lot of products that are have been tested and ready to be rolled out. A mushroom that doesn't brown as much, developed by or bruise as much, developed by Penn State. A range of products in the animal area. Really, we're not doing any research on animal gene editing. Nor are we doing much research or product development in animal GMOs, just because the regulatory structure is so outdated. So there's this real tension, and there's some pressure, I think, on the U.S. government to maybe consolidate animal and crop biotechnology regulations under one umbrella. But right now we have multiple organizations that compete for regulating crops and animals, which really complicates the situation.
And so when you have the website, who is this really targeting? Who's the person you think will get the most information from this? And what are you hoping they really take home?
We tried to make it accessible, but also detailed enough so that anyone who's interested in gene editing, but also journalists or politicians or people who are influential in deciding some of these regulations could go to it and get enough substance and enough clarity to really answer some of their questions and even compare and say, how is a more flexible or clear regulatory framework, how is that helping innovation, and how are some of the other more strict regulations shutting down regulation?
Okay, so all of this sounds really good, but if you're somebody who is, say, listening to this podcast and you want to explore the site, it sounds kind of like, you know, just more information, you know, about these important topics. But what is the real hook? If someone visits your site, what are some of the things that they would expect to find that may be different from other resources and maybe particularly more helpful?
Well, we structured it in a way to appeal, as Kayleen said, to a broad variety of people. First off, we start out with what I would call almost a journalistic summary of what is the situation. It's a snapshot. So we're servicing journalists as well as the general public, regulators, a wide range of people. But we want someone to kind of like get it. Here's the picture. Then we have a list of products that are either developed or in the research stage. So for instance, if you go to the U.S. crop section, you see literally 20 products that are in development. Soybean oil with no trans fat, virus-resistant tomatoes, mildew-resistant wine grapes, high-yield tomatoes, corn with extra starch, a wide variety of things. And it just gives you this amazing sense of, wow, these are sustainable crops that are being developed, low impact, high value, nutrition enhanced, lowering extraneous, highly toxic chemical inputs. So this is valuable information, I think, can be used by a number of different people. We also have a regulatory timeline, which shows how these regulations have evolved over time. And I think that's important because we have to recognize that there's a history, especially in the agricultural area, and a fearfulness about many agricultural innovations because of a fear of technology in general. I call it a techno-pessimism, that the next development is going to lead to some catastrophic development, like ruining our food system or creating chemical pollution that can't be turned around. And so the regulatory timeline really helps in that. One of the most important parts of the site is a section called NGO Reaction, which documents how activist groups are targeting innovation in the biotechnology sphere, and in some cases, promoting misinformation as a way to stop the GMO and gene editing revolution. And so this provides a lot of information that's helpful not only to journalists and scientists, but to regulators to recognize how they are being spun. So we're really trying to be transparent for everyone involved so that there's a level playing field for these products and for the technology.
What was really cool about the website is that, you know, I consider myself kind of an expert in these topics, but as I went through the pages, I found things that I never realized and just like stuff that was completely almost shocking in some ways, particularly with understanding how other countries are regulating the same products and how some ways US looks like we're actually not in the lead in our regulatory conceptualization. And the nice part about this was you could learn so much so fast. You don't have to do a lot of reading. You can just kind of, you know, peruse very colorful, lots of easy ways to do this. And was there really a strategy behind this?
We wanted an index as well as a tracker. And the index is what you're referring to, which is a way to look at country by country, how what kind of friction is there in the regulatory structure. And surprisingly, as you've noticed in reviewing it, the United States is innovative in some areas, but it's a laggard in others. And not surprisingly, perhaps, of people who are familiar with agricultural biotechnology, Europe, which has such a history of scientific innovation, is literally a backwater in agricultural biotechnology. And it's so stark to realize that obscure countries around the world with tiny research budgets are far, far more advanced in allowing industry and scientists and universities to develop these cutting-edge products that can have such a sustainable impact on the environment.
And was it really just gene editing? I know there's also a section on gene drives. And can you tell me a little bit more about that?
We focused on gene editing, and there are various different technologies within gene editing. And then we also added a section on gene drives, which is the most the newest aspect of gene editing. But usually, at least for now, gene drives usually include some gene editing technology and also some GMO technology, some transgenic technology. So that makes it a little more complicated as far as regulations go, because usually they have been regulated differently. And but we wanted to bring it in, even though most countries have not decided yet what they're going to do with gene drives. There's some research going on. There's been tests in the lab, but it's still kind of a current social topic whether we should take species, even if they're extremely harmful. Should we wipe them out? What are going to be the effects of that? How can we control it in an effective way? And all these questions. So we wanted to be kind of at the forefront and put that in, and then we'll sort of track it as it goes along and see how these countries, how we decide this brand new technology should be regulated.
We also believe that there are legitimate ethical and scientific questions, as Kayleen referred to, about gene drives. So we don't want to suggest that lower regulation is always the best way to go. The issue should be smart regulation. And that's especially true in gene drives because they are so complicated. Surely we all want to, would love to see Zika-carrying or malaria-carrying mosquitoes be wiped out. But perhaps there are other questions about how we are manipulating species. And so this is an area of our site that I think stirs an ability to look at things from a wide variety of perspectives, not just purely the scientific.
Well, could you tell me a little bit more about where it's going next? And, you know, it's a really great resource, but it's going to become very cumbersome to continually update because new news is hitting every single day in gene editing. So is this something that you will continually update and maybe take in other directions?
We have been updating day by day almost with new products. And as regulations change or regulations are released, we have been updated and we will continue to do that. I think it is only as useful as it is current. And so we'll continue to do that. And we will especially be adding a more robust product list as we find and more products are developed and commercialized. And so, yes, we will continue to update it and keep it current.
Well, the question always comes up is how is something like this funded? And it must be enormously expensive with the daily updates and the space that it takes. So where does the funding come from to do this? And can people contribute to keeping it alive and growing?
Great question. We actually post on the homepage of this site a transparency statement linking people to our master website, where we list all our donors and access to our federal 990s. This project was funded out of our very small overall budget, where we have a variety of contributors. We don't take money from corporations. We take money from generally the public and foundations, all of which are listed in our 990s or on our site. So to be honest, we are a very small NGO. We only have 3 full-time employees, believe it or not. Kayleen, a neuroscientist, works for us as an editor, but juggles a number of other things in her life, including a beautiful new baby. And we are absolutely looking for people who support science to support this. And if they want to target their donation specifically to the gene editing project, that would be fantastic, because we do anticipate that this will take a considerable amount of resources on a month-by-month basis, somewhat indefinitely, but we think the resource is worth it.
Well, if people want to explore the resource, where do they find it?
Well, we will have it accessible through our website, the Genetic Literacy Project. It's also on a standalone website. Anyone who puts in Genetic Literacy Project Gene Tracker would immediately find it. But as of now, we will prominently display on the GLP homepage a panel that allows people to go directly to this. And then it's a resource that's available to literally anyone, even critics of gene editing or those concerned about the misapplication of this technology.
Well, in all your research to assemble this resource, you must have really seen some trends in how things like gene therapy or human applications in embryos versus agriculture. You know, what are the major trends that you're seeing in terms of how the public is feeling about gene editing?
I think that in the agricultural area, maybe the public doesn't have quite as much of a understanding of exactly what products are even available. And I think if they knew more about what was being developed and exactly how the technology works, they might be open to it, as it provides some avenues for sustainability and addressing climate change. On the health side, I think there's been a lot of news about new therapies, gene therapy and stem cell therapy, that people are excited about, and they inherently understand the value of addressing disease and how these technologies can treat and help some diseases that we haven't had any treatments for in the past. But at the same time, people are understandably very sensitive to editing the human genome, or what that means, or if we should do it. And especially there's been some scientists who have gone ahead of where everyone is comfortable with. And as a Chinese scientist edited the genome of embryos that were then brought to term, twins, and the scientific community and the public were all not comfortable with that, and felt that he broke some barriers there. But it started to kind of make people more aware that we really need to decide as a society how we should regulate and enforce these regulations, and when is it appropriate to address disease through gene editing, and when should it not be appropriate, and those types of questions. So I think there really is a different attitude or feeling for agriculture versus human health, and the regulations should respect that and reflect that in a way that's clear and doesn't stifle innovation, but understands, the ethics about it and are sensitive to that.
Gene editing can be used for human enhancement as well as for disease amelioration. That's the, I think, the real question mark. Do we want to not only get target specific genes that Huntington's disease, for instance, we probably can rid ourselves of that through embryonic manipulation. But what about, do we want someone to be more intelligent? Do we want someone to be taller? Do we want someone to be better looking? These are controversial questions, and they even go deeper than that and are linked to disease. Do we want to rid people of the genes that might cause them to be deaf? There's a deaf community that feels that that is stigmatizing a part of the variety of the human condition. So these are very controversial questions that have ethical weight, and we want to be a place that people can go that they will find neutral information to help inform a better regulatory system going forward.
And along that line, John, you know, do you think that this is really in response to how industry and how science communication fumbled the rollout of transgenics, and that by taking a proactive approach, by putting out transparent and easily accessible information, do you think this can maybe help limit the stigmatization of this technology as they did transgenics?
Well, that's our hope. That was really the driving thought in developing this. We experienced as lay people and you as a scientist, I think with great frustration, this amazing transgenic technology, which began rolling out in the through the 90s and the early 2000s. And yet we had environmental groups, activist groups, that really took the science out of context and demonized it, creating fears of, you know, Franken animals and potential dire unintended consequences, when in fact 25 years later, we've not even had someone develop so much as a sniffle related to the development of GMOs. But yet there was a catastrophe in science communication in the early 2000s, especially, that industry played a large role in, because they weren't so transparent about every aspect of what they were doing. And they also believed that they thought this was gee whiz, everybody will love this technology, and farmers embraced it, you know, head over heels. But the public was wary, and NGOs that are technophobic or at least technoskeptics essentially exacerbated the problem. Gene editing offers an opportunity to set the clock right a little bit.
And I guess maybe the last question is, how many days do you think it will be before people are actively maligning the resource as just another tool of Big Ag to manipulate the consumer?
I think it's, you're already 2 days late on that. it was within hours of rolling it out that we began seeing posts to that effect. And people who don't even know any of the background of it, the development of it, it's just a knee-jerk reaction that anybody or any support for transparency in biotechnology must be suspicious, and there must be some ulterior motive behind it.
Yeah, I know. It's sad that it caught on so quick, but I guess it should be expected. It's their full-time job to make our full-time jobs miserable. So I guess the last thing then would be, where do people find the resource again? You mentioned the URL earlier, but could you hit me with that one more time?
Sure. Well, the central resource for the Genetic Literacy Project, geneticliteracyproject.org, has the gene tracker on it. It's, you know, CRISPR gene editing regs tracker is what it is. But essentially, the GLP should be the resource for it, or search for it in Google. Put in gene tracker regulations, GLP, Genetic Literacy Project, whatever, and it'll immediately come up.
Awesome. So Kayleen Schreiber and John Entine, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It was really exciting to learn about this new resource, and I've had a good time looking at it. So thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
And we'll be back on the second half of the Talking Biotech podcast, really with a tribute to a lost scientist who also was a tremendous friend and a great contributor to the area of Berry research. We'll be back with the Talking Biotech podcast in just a moment. It was great to have the opportunity to talk about the Genetic Literacy Project, a website that has posted daily news about breakthroughs in biotechnology, human medicine, and other contemporary issues in genetics. I hope you visit their website and share the information that's there with others. It's really important. And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. The first week of Patreon support has been amazing and has allowed me to think even bigger. All of the support will go to fund improvements in this podcast as well as spawn new projects, such as a children's book on crop domestication. Every fruit and vegetable has a story, and just about everyone is amazing. I've articulated that in a fun text that I'd like to offer for free. I think that when we put those stories in everyone's hands, it changes perceptions of human influence on plant genetics, changes attitudes towards what is natural, and maybe even can curb food waste. And that's next on my agenda, along with some really cool videos on YouTube, which will deal with academic publishing and career advice for early career scientists. I can take all of these other opportunities on because I have someone else doing the production of the Talking Biotech podcast, thanks to you. There also will be new partnerships in the works with the Genetic Literacy Project, so watch for those too. Now, back to the podcast. So now we're back on the Talking Biotech podcast, and it's a little bit different than our normal segment, and that I really need to spend a few moments to talk about someone who's no longer with us. And every so often we hear about a scientist that's passed away, and usually it's a well-known contributor that left us long after retirement and gives us time to reflect on their contributions. And those are sad times. And I can think of many incredible colleagues and mentors that have left us that gap to fill. And they're sad times, but fully expected. Nobody lives forever. But once in a while, we come to a shocking time where we experience the tragic and unexpected loss of somebody who really is flying high in the prime of their career, and someone we thought would always be there and is there one day and gone the next. And right now, we grieve such a loss in the plant biology community. Episode 186 of the Talking Biotech podcast was an interview with Dr. Chad Finn. He's an internationally recognized small fruit breeder with the USDA ARS in Corvallis, Oregon. He's universally revered and respected not only as an expert in the field, but as a colleague in the sciences, and also as a dear friend to just about everyone who had the pleasure of meeting him. I had the privilege of spending a short time, but intense times with him in various capacities, and I won't go into that because I'll get too damn sad. I'll just say that I was crushed by the news of his passing and have felt an insurmountable loss ever since. And I've written a dozen notes to his family and to his colleagues, and I've sent zero. It seems like a statement of my condolences is really insignificant relative to what his family and close colleagues are experiencing. And I was really in a conundrum about what I could possibly do to better remember his amazing science, his great career, and a really good friend. I thought a fitting tribute might be to use this medium to help others understand his contributions, memorialize his accomplishments, and maybe hear some other reflections from someone that worked with him very closely. So today I'm speaking with Dr. Bernadine Strick from Oregon State University. She's the berry crops research lead at the North Willamette Research and Extension Center. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Strick.
Thank you, Dr. Folta. It's not a very joyous time for us to be chatting, but I really do appreciate the opportunity to share some special moments about Dr. Chad Finn, but also to let people know just how incredible he was and how amazing his accomplishments were. So it's an honor to be able to do that.
No, thank you for joining me. I know that you worked very closely with him over many years. And could you kind of give a little sense of that? Like, when did you start working with him and in what capacity?
Sure. So I've been a professor at Oregon State University for 32 years, and I have known Chad for 26 of those years. Chad was hired in 1996 as the USDA ARS research geneticist. That's what we were supposed to call him, but we all called him the berry crop breeder. And what we had is a very unique relationship because the cooperative breeding program here is the only one of its kind in the world. It's a partnership between the USDA ARS berry crop breeder, which was Chad at the Hortcrops Research Unit here in Corvallis. It's actually based on campus here at Oregon State University. And I'm the OSU horticulturist. So we would actually jointly release cultivars. And the program itself is over 100 years old. And as I said, the only one of its kind in the world. So Chad and I are very almost the same age. And we would always joke that we look pretty damn good for 100 years old. And we would always be teasing each other about who was the oldest and who was the youngest. And he died much too young at 57 years old. And as you said, in the prime of his life, with a tremendous number of accomplishments. Chad would make all the important decisions on what to cross and what might be good parents, and certainly had a tremendous number of partners, genomicists, flavor chemists, virologists, pathologists, did a lot of worked with Dr. Nahala Basil on DNA fingerprinting to learn, you know, what might be key traits that they could focus on. But on the practical end of it, I was his closest partner in terms of horticulture. And so he would make the crosses. He would select the seedlings that showed the most potential compared to industry standards. And then the advanced selections would come to the North Willamette Research and Extension Center, where all the advanced selections would be planted and compared to industry standards. And in addition to, you know, Chad obviously making key evaluations of those, we'd get yield and quality data and bring in other members of the team. Then the fruit would go back to Oregon State University to the Department of Food Science and Technology, where partners in our team would freeze it. And then the industry would be able to evaluate this fruit processed, which is a key industry for us. So Chad and I would often walk the fields, and he would ask my opinion on the horticultural traits and did I think this would be a cultivar that would do well in the industry. And in the end, we jointly released these. It would be a USDA ARS OSU joint release. So I guess what I'd like to do, if it's all right, is just give people an idea of just how productive of a breeder he was, with some of the highlights of what he was able to accomplish.
Well, that sounds really good. Like, what were some of the main crops that he worked on, even, you know, just for the listeners who may not have known him, what are some of the main crops he worked on? And then if you can go into some of those impacts about the major ones that we'd recognize or, you know, the major accomplishments.
Chad, I think, in his 26 years, developed probably the most recognized berry crop breeding program in the world. Chad did germplasm evaluation or breeding in red and black raspberry, blackberry, strawberry, and blueberry, and even did some germplasm evaluation in kiwiberry, particularly Actinidia arguta. And so he co-released an incredible 51 cultivars in those 26 years. And while he may not have been the lead on all 51, because that's what co-release means, it indicates just how collaborative his program was. He worked very closely with the breeder at Washington State University, who's now retired, Dr. Pat Moore, with the various breeders in Agri-Food and Ag Canada and British Columbia, Hugh Dobney, then Chaim Kempler, and then Michael Dossett. Certainly with another premier blackberry breeder in the world, Dr. John Clark, and then various colleagues like Jim Hancock at Michigan State University. And I hate leaving somebody out, but those are the key ones that come to mind at this point. And so he was recognized certainly as a premier blackberry breeder. In our region, we are the the United States' largest blackberry production region, and Chad developed the first genetically thornless trailing blackberries in the world, and his Black Diamond and Columbia Star are now the most widely planted in our industry. And he also released Obsidian Trailing Blackberry, which is grown for fresh market in Oregon, but is also grown in Europe. And Columbia Star is also being tested and grown in Europe. And then, as far as I know, he's the only one who has released blackberry cultivars that have combined traits of trailing blackberries with the Eastern type of blackberry. And so these are his goal, as Chad would always have said it, his goal was to produce a late season, firm, fresh market blackberry that would surpass Chester Thornless, which is considered the industry standard, which many feel has no flavor. And he did that, releasing Galaxy, Eclipse, and Twilight, which are brand new, and I think they will revolutionize the fresh blackberry market. So he had big impacts in blackberry. And then when we look at strawberry, we have a processed strawberry industry. I think we still rank third in the U.S. for strawberry, a long, long distant third after California and Florida. But we grow high flavor strawberries for processed specialty markets like high value ice creams, etc. And Tillamook, which is a cultivar that Chad released, is the most widely planted strawberry in this region. And then in raspberries, Chad released two Primacane fruiting, late season raspberries, red raspberries, Vintage and Kokanee, that are very widely planted. And finally, in blueberries, it's just a shame that he won't be able to see the impact some of these new releases will have on the industry. Mini Blues is a new high bush blueberry, very cold hardy. It's a northern high bush that is, in my opinion, and I've tasted many blueberries throughout the world, the most intensely flavored small fruited blueberry available, and it can be grown conventional or organic. And it's just an incredible addition to the palette of cultivars that are available. And he and I were working very closely on developing production systems that could be used to minimize hands-on, so minimize labor with machine harvest and no pruning for several years. And we're making great progress in that. So to sum up kind of his impact, he was a regional breeder, so he was very interested and required to look at impacts that he could have in the Northwest. And so he kept track of impacts on nursery plant sales and fruit sales. And his impact is absolutely mind-blowing. $450 million impact of his cultivars over the last 10 years. That is a phenomenal impact to industry. And I really do want to say that Chad had an incredibly close relationship with the industry. And that is something that he would be so incredibly proud of, would be to have that kind of impact to the industry.
That's all really great. It really does sum it up very well, especially when you consider that most plant breeding programs that are either at ARS or university based, if you're producing a cultivar every 15 years or every 10 years, you're doing pretty well, because that takes a long time to do these things. And the fact that he was able to do 51 over, 26 years is a real testament to, like you say, the interaction and the collegiality, but also what must be an amazing work ethic that, from what I could tell, never seemed to quit. I guess I'm having trouble formulating the next question, but even when his productivity was amazing, yet he still had so many other impacts in terms of helping students, in terms of impacts with the associations and national societies. And could you comment a little bit on that?
Oh, I'm happy to, because, our families are very similar. he and his wife, two sons, and me and my husband have two daughters, similar ages. And he and I always, when we interact with students from undergraduates to graduates and junior scientists, have always shared, often over a beer, how important it is when we mentor these more junior people to have that work-life balance. And Chad, I hope I've done that, but Chad did an exemplary job at this. He really said to junior faculty, who miss him tremendously as a mentor, and junior scientists at the ARS, that you, in order to be effective, you have to be effective in all aspects of your life. And so an example of that professionally was that Chad was passionate about every step of the process. It wasn't just getting a cultivar, but it was getting the funding and working with colleagues to be effective at that. It was working with colleagues to include them in the project so that they could also be successful, and then publishing that refereed paper at the end and releasing the cultivar and following through to make sure it was a good cultivar, and if not, to improve upon it. Personally, boy, to say Chad lived life to the fullest would really be an understatement. He was an incredible family man and would travel a lot with his family. We often went to scientific meetings together and would add personal time and go hiking. Known as a plant geek, loved plants. He and my husband were real like-minded about that. And yes, he worked hard. In fact, he usually opened the gates at the research station and would always text me photos of sunrise. And it got to the point where I would think he was bragging that he was there so early. And that was just the way he was, very much a morning person, worked very hard and played very hard. And, you know, it is tragic to have lost him at such a young age, but you know, Chad passed away doing, you know, what he would say would be a better way than passing away at his desk. Let me say, he was vacationing with family and having a good time, and it was a tragic accident. And I think he would prefer that way than dying at his desk. The other thing I want to say about him is something you've mentioned and alluded to, and everyone who met him noticed. To say Chad had a joie de vivre is an understatement. I mean, he was always smiling, had an incredibly infectious laugh. You could find him in a crowded room just by waiting a few seconds and waiting till he laughed. He never needed a microphone when giving a talk. He changed the dress code at professional meetings to shorts, tie-dye, and if he had to, long pants and a bow tie. He gave hugs that literally broke someone's ribs once, so I had to work out to strengthen mine. And incredible sense of humor, incredibly giving. Everyone he met wasn't a stranger for long. They became a friend. And he and his wife and family always had an open door for visitors and scientists. And our program was always a revolving door of people who wanted to visit with Chad and walk his plots. And that's why he's touched so many. I mean, we had a celebration of life in mid-January. I was honored to be asked by the family to speak at that. And I mean, there were more than 550 people crowded into the room. He touched so many people, and many flew a long distance to come and share that celebration of life. So as sad as we are, he would want us all to think about the good things and to toast him when we next can.
Yeah, that's I really wanted to make it out to the celebration, but it's a long haul from Gainesville, Florida to Corvallis, Oregon. That's like a, you know, and especially on short notice, relatively short notice. But the one thing that you alluded to there that was really something I think about is, what do we learn from the people who have left us, who that we can try to pick up where they left off? What are the things we can do better? And I think his commitment to development of younger personalities, the fact that everybody was his friend, those are the things that I think places that we can all learn from him and in his honor, do better ourselves. And very glad you brought, I'm glad you brought that up. So when I go through his accomplishments and I look at, you know, you filled in certainly his accomplishments as a plant breeder and certainly personally, you look online, he's got almost 7,000 citations. The guy was a scholar. He was a friend, you know, all the way across the board. But is there anything else that you would really like to wrap up with as somebody who worked extremely closely with him for a long time?
Yeah, I think the thing that is important for people to know is that just how well recognized he was, not just by industry and colleagues internationally. He was invited everywhere. I mean, I can think of very few countries he wasn't invited to speak about breeding in particular. He was very active in the International Society for Horticultural Science, co-convening a couple of symposia. He was extremely active in our American Society for Horticultural Science, and in fact received their highest honor, a fellow, in 2010, which is certainly very significant. And then the ARS gave him a technology transfer award, and he's received many awards. He's an alumnus at Purdue and received their Distinguished Alumnus Award. And these are just testaments to how well respected he was by colleagues and scientists. And, you know, the world has lost just a simply outstanding berry crop breeder. Many of us have lost an amazing colleague and, of course, as I've mentioned, a friend of so many people here and worldwide. And I think Chad is going to be remembered for a long time for his accomplishments, you know, how generous he was, how big his heart was, and he his very bright personality, and he'll be greatly missed.
Yes, he is already, and it's just, it really has left a shock throughout our community, and I think so many people have reached out to talk about it, and I really appreciate that they'll have the opportunity to hear it from you, someone who works so closely with them. So, Dr. Bernadine Strick, thank you so much for spending the time with me today, and maybe we'll see you pretty soon.
Thank you very much.
And I neglected to add that Dr. Chad Finn was featured on the podcast recently in episode 186. And I'm so grateful to have captured his story, his enthusiasm, his passions, his kind friendship. It's now permanently part of the series here and part of his electronic legacy. And if you haven't heard it, go give it a listen. And thank you to Dr. Strick. Losing a friend is never easy. And I'm grateful she was here to tell the story. Thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.
The Talking Biotech Podcast represents the views of Dr. Kevin Folta and his guests and does not represent the views of the University of Florida, its faculty, staff, students, or administration. Send your comments and suggestions to kevinfolta@gmail.com. And if you're so inclined, send us a little love over on the Patreons. Your support of the mission will translate into more science communication efforts with greater reach and influence, helping ultimately to bring innovation to application through communication. I'm Vern Blazek, and thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.